Hi, everyone, and welcome to Game of Thrones and Medievalism, a podcast created for a fourth-year history course at the University of Northern British Columbia. In this podcast, our goal is to think about Game of Thrones in the context of medievalism. That is, how the Middle Ages is constructed on Game of Thrones and what that can tell us about our own society and its views of the past. On May 17th, 2015, Episode 6 of Season 5 of Game of Thrones aired, titled Unbowed, Unbent, Unbroken. It featured the rape of Sansa Stark by her new husband, the universally despised Ramsay Bolton. Negative reaction to the episode was swift, in popular media and on message boards alike. What was viewed as gratuitous violence was condemned. But why? Sexual violence had long been a part of Game of Thrones. By season 5, there were many examples of such violence on the show. So today we're going to explore some of the answers to that question, but also think about why Game of Thrones features so much sexual violence. Is it a reflection of the medieval period, or another example of medievalism? We'll also delve into another aspect of the show that is often viewed with distaste, incest, and think about how incest was defined and considered in medieval Europe. My guests to help us explore these complicated and difficult subjects is Dr. Sarah McDougall, an associate professor at John Jay College and the CUNY Graduate Center in New York. She specializes in medieval legal history with a focus on crime and gender. Her numerous publications include two books, Bigamy and Christian Identity in Late Medieval Champagne from UPenn, and Royal Bastards, The Birth of Illegitimacy, 800 to 1230, from Oxford University Press. So hi, Sarah, and thank you so much for agreeing to speak with us today. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to do so.
It's my great pleasure, Dana.
Our focus for this week is on sexual violence and incest in Game of Thrones, exploring it in the context of medieval history and modern popular culture. And these are two aspects of the show that are very controversial, especially in relation to the story arcs of particular characters. So I wanted to start with that and think about sexual violence as it's related to the storyline of numerous female characters on Game of Thrones, but also in the book that the series is based on. So why do you think creators felt the need that to do this, to highlight sexual violence in the storyline of these characters?
So I think there's probably two different motivations. One is that the author of the series, Martin, and the people involved in writing the show all clearly seem to have adhered to the sort of dark view of the Middle Ages. And so because they see the Middle Ages as so violent and so sexually exploitative of women, it makes sense that they would want to have that in their work. And certainly that is one of the shared perceptions of what the Middle Ages was like, and one that a lot of modern people adhere to for one reason or another. My second reason that I would give is that they think that sexual violence sells, right? That it's going to attract an audience, that people want to see or read about sex, and I guess especially violent sex, that is going to interest and provoke a reaction, which is certainly what they got, although possibly more than what they wanted.
Yeah, perhaps not the reaction that they may have hoped to get. And some of the readings that we've done for this course have referred to Martin's perception, and then also Benioff and Weiss. They refer to this as a grim, dark representation of the Middle Ages, right? Where things were all terrible and life was hard and violent and hypersexualized. What do you think this says then about their perception of women's lives in the Middle Ages? If they felt that this is supposed to be this grim, dark medieval period, and we need to have this particular representation of it. What do you think it says about how they themselves thought about women in the medieval period?
Well, they certainly seem to be seeing women as constantly at risk of this kind of violence, and from everyone, from not just from the passing soldier, but from their husband and from their brother, and that there is this sense that everywhere you went as a woman, and perhaps also as a man, and especially a young man, you might be at risk that somebody would just grab you and do whatever they wanted to you. That certainly seems to be something they think was possible in the Middle Ages, or even
Yeah,
probable.
I think that then becomes a perception that people watching the show have. I know when I tell people I'm teaching a course on Game of Thrones as a historian, they always say, "Oh yeah, I bet, that's so much like what the Middle Ages was like, right?" And I'm like, "Well, no, it's not." But people argue with me, right? And are invested. And in their eyes, Game of Thrones is a realistic portrayal of the medieval period. And I think part and parcel of that is the representation of women as these victims of male sexual violence.
I think it's probably safer and possibly, I hope, more accurate to think instead that I mean, at least to me, what's useful about Game of Thrones is it's illustrating the possibility, the unfortunately very real possibility that terrible things could happen to women in particular, like some of the things that are happening in Games of Thrones. The question we don't know the answer to is how often. We'd never be able to know how often these things really happened. It seems a bit too dark, certainly, to think that they happened to the extent that they happened in Game of Thrones. But this is the problem with sexual assault always, is that you never would know all of it. You only get a fragment of the knowledge. And so it's a difficult thing to try to talk about. But certainly, I think it's fair to see Game of Thrones as an expression of a possible dark reality that is not the totality of what went on in the Middle Ages. And certainly it's such a diverse thing, the Middle Ages. It's so many different times and places, and with so many different kinds of cultures and societies all mixed in, even more diverse maybe than the Seven Kingdoms. So certainly it covers more time than the Seven Kingdoms.
You've raised a couple really important threads that I want to pull at in your comments. So Martin has talked a lot about the fact that his books are meant to challenge this Disneyfied version of the medieval period as Bright and Merry, and he wants to present this more realistic representation of history. And as you've just noted, studying sexual violence in the medieval period is really hard for all kinds of reasons. So can you tell us a little bit about what we do know about women's experience of sexual violence in the medieval period?
So, we certainly know that some women were raped. We know that some women were raped by people close to them and by people not close to them. And we know that there was also a whole spectrum of coercion and violence and threat of force that would be exercised against women. And we know also that in some cases, at least, there were legal systems in place that did do some things about it, and there were also more informal mechanisms for dealing with it. Extrajudicial violence was certainly one of the responses. There's laws condemning it everywhere, whether or not they were actually applied, and how, and what these courts required of people willing to make an accusation is a whole nother issue by and large.
Can you maybe expand a little bit about the type of sources that we can use to study rape then? So if we know that there's laws against it, and we know that most parts of Europe do have some kind of at least legal framework that these cases could potentially be tried in. So how do you, as a historian who looks at what happened in terms of sexual violence, how do you study that history? And what are the types of sources that you use? And can you give me some examples of those sources?
Yeah, so I work mostly on France. You can find, if you're looking, you can find evidence of sexual violence in almost every kind of source. You can find it in the laws, as we both just said. You can find it in the court records, which I can talk about in more detail, both accusations of rape and prosecutions of alleged rapists, the sentences passed against the convicted rapists, and royal pardons for those who've been condemned to death or who are at risk of being condemned to death for rape, who the king decides should be spared execution. So there's all of those different kinds of legal sources. There's also notarial records, so things that were written down by notary to make legally formal agreements for an exchange of money to provide compensation to the woman or to her family to deal with it out of court. Or you also have litigation and pardons for people who have killed someone and they say that it was because it was a rape. So to punish the alleged rapist by killing them. There's also miracle stories that mention rape. So when there people are giving testimony about something miraculous a saint did, you can find mentions of rape there. You can also find it in some letters and you can find it in stories, both serious romance stories and also comic stories, which is extremely disturbing and something that scholars really struggle to deal with. But the logistics of what people had to do to make an accusation is worth describing in a little detail. So at least in 14th century France, to give an example, if a woman or someone on the behalf of that woman wanted to make a rape accusation, they would usually bring a case before a royal court or a local lord. It's possible that if it was a priest, it would be handled by a religious court also, but I'll stick with the secular court. So in the secular court, you would go to the relevant official, you would make the accusation, and often because of the seriousness of the accusation, because there's a risk of execution for the person who's being accused, you might yourself be detained in prison. So either the woman herself or whoever's making the accusation on her behalf, while they're investigating and questioning the accused, who might then claim that he's not subject to the jurisdiction of that place, he might go somewhere else. But if he can't get that to work, then, and if they can find him, he's imprisoned also and questioned. And then there's the possibility of a confrontation between the accuser and accused, where the woman has to maintain her story and they're checking to make sure that she doesn't change anything about what she said happened.
Interesting. I had no idea that they would confront them. That's fascinating.
Yeah, not always, but often. And it's possible also that she might be examined. They might decide that it's necessary to have some women, usually with some medical expertise, midwives or something like that, to examine her to see if it looks like she was raped, or in particular, if she's someone who, in principle, hadn't had sex, then if it had shown that she had very recently had sex and there were signs of force, that might be used as evidence. That's not something you find that often in the records, but you find it sometimes. And if he continued to deny it at that point and she maintained her story, he might then be tortured to see if he would confess. And if he confessed, either before or after the torture, he could be sentenced to execution and he might be executed. And so this is the darkest possibility for what could have happened, how terrifying it is for the woman above all, but in all respects, it's a rather troubling method of determining guilt or innocence for everybody involved. What it asked of the woman in particular is just quite hard to feel at all good about.
It sounds very similar to how rape cases were dealt with until fairly recently. And you can understand why a few victims would have come forward to even make an accusation to begin with.
Right, it's quite something that they did, especially since there would have also been all kinds of reasons to not want anyone to know all of the feelings that you would have, in addition to the fear of what might happen to you, of the possibility that the accused rapist, that his family or his friends might do something to you or your family. It's not a justice system that's easy to feel good about. And the risk of execution too is not something that I at least am comfortable with. I would like there to be other ways of handling rape for sure.
I have written a little bit about rape in my own work, but mostly through legal codes. And I've only come across one notarial document dealing with the rape of a young girl. She was under the age of 12. I think she was probably quite young. They don't give her exact age. But just reading that as a historian, I found so hard to read because it was detailing the things that had happened and an agreement that was being made. And it was so hard to read that because when we do our work, we want to be able to speak with the voices of the people that we're studying. I feel like on the one hand, it's really important that we do that work and speak about and be able to speak for these women. But on the other hand, it's really hard.
It's extremely hard, and it's a hard thing to ask students to do too. And so you out there are appreciated for your willingness to tackle these really difficult topics. It's difficult, but it's important to try to understand how a society dealt with what it considered to be a terrible crime, and to understand what they were willing to do and not do about it, when they were willing to see it as.
That's a topic that in my women's history courses we've explored before, because I think students have a perception that in the medieval period that they just didn't bother, right? Rape was not seen as a serious crime, and so women were at the mercy anyways, and legal systems didn't bother to do that. And I think part of the reason why they get that perception is that there's this belief that women were somehow men's property, and so that allowed them the ability to do with them what they wanted. And one of the questions they always ask me is, what about in a marital relationship?
So did married men have the right to rape their wives?
And that's part of the particular episode that we're focusing on for this class, which is Unbowed, Unbent, and Unbroken. This particular episode brought a lot of very harsh criticism on Benioff and Weiss when it was aired in 2015. It features the character my students have decided is the most evil character in the show, Ramsay Bolton, who rapes Sansa Stark on their wedding night. And I've spoken to a lot of people who actually stepped away from the show entirely or stopped watching it for a while because of this particular scene, which wasn't in the books. It was something that was added by the two producers. So why do you think this particular episode has garnered so much criticism and made people extremely upset about it? Which is interesting because nobody said anything about Drogo raping Dany on their wedding night, right? Or the other sexual violence that happens in the show. So what do you think it was about this particular example?
I don't know. Some of it could be horror fatigue. We've gotten to a certain point where just so many women have been treated so horribly in this show. And in particular, Sansa, I think people really empathize with in a deep way and feel for, and also want her at least to be able to be safe from the excesses of the show, but evidently not. I guess I remember hearing too that it was considered gratuitous, that we already knew he was the worst on the show. He didn't have to do anything more. He had the prize for the most terrible of terrible. He didn't have to be shown doing anything any more terrible. So I think that's part of what was upsetting to people. But I honestly don't know.
I think those are all good answers. And I think part of the reason why people don't get as upset or there isn't as much commentary about Dany and Drogo is that the way that they've developed the Dothraki in this particularly racialized way is this is an expected behavior for them, right? So Drogo doing this is
okay, putting in quotation marks, because that's what's expected of his type of character. But you're right, Ramsay is an awful human being. And I think people just would have assumed that's what would have happened anyways. So I don't think they needed to, even though it's off camera and there's the auditory parts of it, I think it was really unnecessary, and that they could have showed Sansa being treated poorly by Ramsay, and they do in many other ways, but I think it was completely unnecessary. That's what a lot of people criticized as. But there's this sense that Benioff and Weiss said to themselves, well, these things happened, right? Women were raped by their husbands. It's like, well, okay, yeah, but that doesn't mean that you necessarily have to gratuitously do that. And I think it's part of this kind of grim, dark idea that we have to represent in the Middle Ages and all of its terribleness. Could a married woman be raped by her husband? What was rape defined as in the medieval period?
In the marriage law that was put out there throughout the medieval Christian European lands, there was this idea of the marital debt, it's called, which they take from St. Paul and the Bible. And the idea is that when you enter into a marriage, your body no longer belongs to you, it belongs to your spouse, and the reverse. And related to that is another idea that you as a spouse, one of your main obligations as a good spouse is to help your spouse not commit adultery, because adultery is very bad. And the best way in principle that you can ensure that your spouse does not feel the need to have sex with anyone other than you is for you to provide that sex as often as it is requested. And that is in principle a completely equal opportunity rule. It applies for the man and the woman equally. Then there's all of these questions about when there could be exceptions to that. And so, because there are certain times and places and situations in which it would be better if you didn't have sex, where it is even considered sinful to have sex. So, for example, it's sinful to have sex in church. So the church lawyer types who talked about these things in their writings would say things like, is it a sin to have sex with your spouse in church? Well, yes, but it's a sin for the person who asks for the sex, not for the person who gives the sex, because in giving the sex, they're preventing the other spouse from committing adultery. And so on and so forth. So if you're having sex at a forbidden time because it's a very important feast day or something like that. So there's all of those kinds of rules. And then where there's a gender difference, it's considered a less than ideal idea to have sex with your wife during her period for complicated medical sort of purity, weird reasons. And then also when she's very late in her pregnancy, if there's some risk to the child. And so those are possibilities, right? But other than that, it is in principle completely egalitarian. Haha. The problem is, of course, that it's complicated to imagine how all of this would get played out. There are some court cases where women went to the church official and said, my husband refuses to have sex with me, and they might actually make the guy come to court and say to him, look, you have an obligation. You have to sleep with your wife and be nice to her. And if you don't, we're going to threaten you with excommunications and fines. And men could certainly do the same thing for a wife. But all of that is my backhanded way of getting at why it would be hard to talk about something like marital rape in the context of this legal system because of that mutual ownership of bodies. You're not technically supposed to be able to say no to your spouse. Now, there's a woman doing a dissertation at Oxford looking at these questions for mostly later medieval France. And I know she spent a couple of years looking for cases. And so it's possible that she's found some, because all of that I just said doesn't talk about violence. And that is something that in my own research I have failed to think through. Are you allowed to violently force yourself on your spouse, even if they say no? And I don't know the answer to that. I hope she does, because certainly the various legal definitions for rape tend to require some sort of force or threat of force, and the threat of force is even sometimes enough. But all this is to say it's difficult to talk about marital rape. It's not as difficult as I thought, but it's difficult to talk about because of that idea of ownership. But that doesn't resolve the violence question.
Several years ago, I taught a modern European women's history course that covered 1800 to the present at that time. And I was really surprised to learn that in England, marital rape was not actually a crime until the 20th century, until well into the 1960s.
It's bad in the US also. I
Yeah.
don't know for Canada.
Probably similar to the British. Now, the community may have shamed people for these actions, right? And I have actually seen court cases in the medieval period where the community will shame a husband for having beaten his wife or not treated her the way that she should be. And they always say it's gone beyond what's acceptable. But in terms of marital rape, I haven't seen that
I have
yet.
seen things like that too, where if a husband is seen to treat his wife badly, that the brothers or the in-laws or even his own family might step in for sure. I've seen both violence and negotiated settlements where she'll come back and live with you, but only if you agree to treat her well, which includes not just don't beat her and lock her up. Don't beat her excessively, I should say.
Beyond excesses, yeah. The use of excessive force is what they. The particular case that I found was a woman who had applied to the civil court to get her dowry returned to her because her husband beat her so badly that she had left him. And so all their neighbors come forth and testify about his terrible behavior. And the court rules no, because under Roman law, domestic violence is not a reason to get your dowry back. Now, that doesn't mean that she couldn't have gone to the church court and then pursued a separation, in which case that might have given her a path to do that. But her initial attempt has said, no, that's not acceptable. And we don't really know the details. They talk about the particular wounds on her face and what they had seen happen. They have a barber surgeon that comes in and testifies to the wounds and how deep they were. I don't know what happens after that, but I just have this particular moment of this one court case.
There are other cases where the women do win,
Yes,
which is
yes.
an important corrective to Game of
Yeah.
Thrones too, right? It's because
Yes.
the grim dark is there, but then there's also these women who do get legal help, even without violence, even with husbands who are dissipating their wealth or treating them badly in some other way, not treating them in the manner to which they are accustomed, which is my favorite little stuck phrase from
Yeah,
modern.
my dowry restitution case is from Valencia. I had a lot of that. He has abused my goods. And they don't actually have to say what he's done, but just he's not administering them well. And my cases that I had for a 20-year period, only three women lost
Wow.
out of 200 cases. So there are ways that women are able to have this legal success too, which I think it's important to point out, right? That it's not just a story of oppression all the time, that women do have an ability to succeed in various ways to protect themselves and their families.
And special note for the class, it is your professor who is the best person to read on that subject. So
Thank you.
if you're going to read anyone, they're number one on my reading list on this topic is definitely the person I am speaking to.
So, sexual violence is one of the controversial topics that Game of Thrones brings up in relationship to sexuality, but the other one is incest. And not only in terms of Cersei and Jaime's relationship, which is a relationship both consensual and at times not consensual, but also the Targaryen practice of sibling marriage. And in Westeros, incest is perceived as a heinous crime and taboo. And the Targaryens are looked down upon, and this is considered to be their downfall, right? The fact that they have engaged in incest. So, how is incest viewed in medieval Europe, and how reflective is Westeros' real horror of it, reflective of what happened in medieval Europe?
So there's generally a pretty strong horror of incest, although a complicated one. The definition of what counted as incest varied to a point that can be mind-numbingly frustrating. The degrees of relationship that counted as incestuous varied enormously over time. And whether that included kin by marriage or not, it might also include kin by godparentage. It might also include kin by a sort of sexual relationship or promises to marry. There were all of these different ways that incest could also be used to describe a spiritual relationship with your priest. The term is used really broadly and selectively. So on the one hand, there is a clear horror of incest. On the other hand, what exactly counted as incest changes. Certainly brother, sister, really not okay. There are some cases I know of. There was a particularly one from 14th century France that's too wild not to briefly share. So this is the Count of Armagnac was having a secret relationship with his sister and had a handful of children with her. And then he at some point actually managed to hire this guy to write a fake papal letter saying that he had a dispensation to marry his sister.
Wow.
This did not work because because everybody knew that this is not possible. But that is a kind of fun way to segue into what was possible. So everybody says the incest is bad. On the other hand, a lot of these royal families, like the people in Game of Thrones, often have to make these political unions with people who are technically related to them within these forbidden degrees. And so it often was possible for them to either do it and have nobody say anything or do it and get some kind of special permission if someone did say something, usually from the Pope. And then in other cases, people would get married, either get the papal permission or not. And then if they needed to end the marriage because they wanted to marry somebody else, that became a really useful pretext. Or if you didn't like the fact that somebody was married to somebody else, you might use their relationship as a pretext. So incest is really funny in the medieval context because there's clearly horror of it and there's all of these laws condemning it and efforts to define and redefine and try to make sure that people did not marry their close kin. But at the same time, they did marry close kin all the time, not brother, sister. That one is exceptional, but cousins, second cousin, there is a fair amount of that. And then there's just a question of, is it bad or is it useful that we can say that it's bad so that we can do what we want to do? It becomes a way to get out of a marriage or to attack somebody else's marriage. It also has an interesting tie-ins to the reflection of the seriousness of it is there will often be rules that children of incest can't inherit, but they don't define which kinds of incest, or they'll say things like children of incest can't be priests, but they won't say what kinds of incest. Then that also comes into the whole complex legal handling of something that was clearly upsetting. It's something you could be prosecuted for too. I have some court cases where brothers and sisters caught incest are prosecuted. Fathers who committed incest with their daughters are prosecuted and executed. These cases, at least, were clearly taken extremely seriously.
That's good. What I find interesting is that what you've just given us a really nuanced discussion of how we think about incest as a historical subject. And all of that is glossed over in Game of Thrones, right? Jaime and Cersei's relationship is wrong and all of their children are killed as a result of their sins, right? And then the Targaryen practice of sibling marriage is just viewed as something that's what has created the madness in their family is this. So it's very heavy-handed treatment. Yet, as you said, at the same time, it's clear that these various houses are intermarrying and they have a lot of connection together in terms of their bloodlines and where they come from. And all of that's just ignored, right? And it's a TV show. I guess we can't hold it to too much account.
But they're missing an awfully legal point. I mean, maybe that kingdom had different incest laws, and so we shouldn't, they weren't medievalizing in that respect. But considering the sources that Martin was supposed to be using, yeah, he missed an opportunity to have a lot of fun with the law.
Yes, I think so. We have a class on law where we're going to talk about trial by ordeal in particular and different ways of judging how the legal framework worked in the past. So my final question for you is, given that incest and sexual violence are central themes on this show, what does this tell us about people's perceptions of the Middle Ages, and how do we challenge those perceptions, particularly as gender historians?
That's a good one. So, and it's a hard one to answer. Some of it we've talked about already, right? There were terrible things happening to women in the Middle Ages, for sure. There were people doing terrible things in the Middle Ages, for sure. But where do we push back? Where do we want to say this feels wrong to me? One of the main things I like to try to challenge in these kinds of scenarios, which I don't know if it's about me as a gender historian. I think it is in a way.
Yeah.
One of the main differences between now and the Middle Ages that is so hard for us to fully wrap our minds around is the great degree of unknown and inability to apply things as fully as we do now. There's no way, for example, to know for certain a lot of things that we can know for certain. There are no paternity tests. There wasn't even a registration system. You could not look up what year somebody was born. You can't find out for sure who their parents were. There's no way to know any of that. And there's no way to know what really happened for them. They couldn't find out, let alone us. And then related to that, in a way, their unknowing about these things is compared to what we can do now is similar to when we have a law or an idea of how things ought to be. We can expect more application than they could have ever. And so for there to be a law that says that such and such a crime is punished by death, that doesn't mean it was ever carried out, ever, or that they even could have thought or hoped or expected that it would be, or that it would be for everyone. And I feel like being a gender historian is something that makes you hypersensitive to the fluidity, the possible ambiguity and fluidity of the thing that you're looking at. And medieval Europe definitely, however diverse it was, however much change over time there was, definitely had so much more nuance and complexity and unknown than there is in the grim, dark Game of Thrones. And even though there are powerful women in Game of Thrones who manage to do incredible things despite the horrible things that are happening to them, I think that's one of the ways that the show feels a little hard for gender scholars of the Middle Ages to feel comfortable with.
Thank you so much for taking your time today to share your wisdom with us. I really enjoyed our conversation, although it raised some really difficult subjects. I think they're important ones for us to talk about. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it too, with the same qualification.